This is The Beat, a podcast series that keeps you in the know about the latest community policing topics facing our nation.
Hello and welcome. My name is Tanine Bradford, and on behalf of the COPS office, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. David Altshuler, a principal research scientist with Johns Hopkins University and a national reentry expert. He's here to talk with us today about juvenile reentry. Dr. Altshuler, can you start by describing the process of juvenile reentry?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think there is a common myth that juvenile reentry is about the reentry into the community of juveniles who are coming back from out-of-home placement, and the effort is really about what happens shortly before release, if we're lucky, and in many instances, we're really talking about what happens when these young people return to the community, and not very much is happening in preparation for their return early enough. The process of juvenile reentry, I believe strongly, is something that needs to be incorporated into our thinking from the very, very beginning. And in fact, even at the point of disposition, when a decision is being made regarding out-of-home placement, whether it's to a correctional facility or some kind of alternative residential program of one sort or another, that we really need to take into consideration what the implications are for where this young person is going to be returning. So we may want to be thinking about an out-of-home placement that would be relatively close to the community to which the child is going to return. So it would be my view that reentry is a process that really begins to be taken into account the point at which a decision is made to place out of home, that it gets incorporated into what's happening from day one when there is an out-of-home placement admission, that this sort of continues to be the focus of attention, that the period of time shortly before release to the community is when we should be finalizing the plans for reentry. Typically what happens is that period of 30, 60, or 90 days before release, when we hear about discharge planning, that should be when we're finalizing discharge planning, not beginning discharge planning. Oftentimes 30, 60, or 90 days before release is really a dollar short and a day late. And then, of course, we're talking about the point at which there actually is community reentry. I think we need to think about it as a staged process. Initially, upon reentry into the community, we need to be thinking much more intensively about what's going on. And then if it turns out that things are going reasonably well, we can basically do more step down. We can gradually ease up on things. But we would want to look a lot more closely and be more intensified, particularly during that early stage of reentry into the community. And then eventually we understand that these young people are no longer going to be under the authority of the justice system at all, and we need to be taking steps to link them in to the supports, both formal and informal, that they're going to need as they ultimately get on with the rest of their lives and hopefully become law-abiding, tax-paying, and productive citizens.
Great. So how are juvenile justice systems organized? You talked about staging processes when dispositions. And what does the organization of the various systems mean for juvenile reentry?
Well, actually, there are a variety of different forms that we can see when we look at juvenile justice across the country. The truth is that in many ways we're talking about 50-plus juvenile justice systems, because the states, the District of Columbia, and other territories are structured and operate in very, very different ways. And the truth is that depending upon the way that the various systems are structured, there are all kinds of implications for how to be thinking about the way juvenile reentry is going to be approached. Let me give a little plug. Actually, if anybody is interested in looking at a more detailed description of exactly how many and what form, they can go on the National Reentry Resource Center website, which is nationalreentryresourcecenter.org. And there is a Juvenile Justice Frequently Asked Questions document, which I was involved in producing, that describes all the different versions. For present purposes, though, I think it's just important to understand that depending upon the structure, we're going to have to think a little bit differently about the best way to approach juvenile reentry. In some states and jurisdictions, for example, the portion of supervised release, that is the community corrections piece, the post-release piece of reentry, actually is within the same agency that handles the facility piece. That's not true everywhere, but it's true in some places. In other places, the community supervision post-release stage is actually handled by a unit or an entity that is in an entirely separate agency. In fact, in some cases, it might be handled by individuals who work at the local level, and they don't even work for the state, whereas in the institution or in the facility, they may actually work for the state. So in some instances, we're talking not merely about a different unit within an agency, but we're talking about an entirely different agency. Depending on whether or not we're talking about the same agency or a different agency, one level of government or a different level of government, whether or not community-based reentry services in the community is handled and under the authority of the local courts, which it is in some jurisdictions, or whether or not it stays within the same agency, we're really going to need to think very differently about how we organize the team, because the division of labor may require taking into account the very different organizational structures that we face. So it's not going to look the same everywhere. Some people, I think, falsely assume that just because the community-based post-release supervision piece is in the same agency as the facility piece, that that would naturally mean that things would be connected and things would be consistent. And the truth is that in many instances, that's not the case at all. And you'd be hard-pressed to understand that they actually are in the same umbrella agency because they don't really communicate very well. They have a very different view about what the priorities are and what they ought to be doing. And they may not even know very much about what's happened either in the stage prior to release, or if they're in the facility, they may know very little to nothing about what's going to happen back out in the community. Depending upon all of those factors, it seems to me that we need to think about how we can create these teams. And really, the team needs to be comprised of the staff that are going to be the key players, both during the period of out-of-home placement or in correctional facilities, as well as the staff who are involved back out in the community. And I have to add to that that number of instances we're also talking about outside service providers. They need to be a part of the team. We're talking about nonprofit organizations. We're talking about the faith-based community. We're potentially talking about mentors, family members. We really need to be thinking about how we're going to incorporate all of these different players from the very, very beginning. The sooner that we get all of the different stakeholders and team members involved in understanding what's going on all along the way, I think the better off we're going to be in terms of trying to establish as much continuity and consistency as going to be required, because continuity and consistency is really the key thing for a lot of these young people, and they haven't had it before they've gotten into the system, and sometimes they get very little of it when they're involved in the system. So it's up to us to take the different structures and the different bureaucratic arrangements that we find in different jurisdictions and figure out how it is that we can build in continuity and consistency and reinforcement, because I think that's going to really be the key ingredients to being successful in doing reentry.
Well, that transitions really well into the next question, because we're talking about consistency and continuity and a team approach to helping these young people reenter the communities. And that's important because I understand there are obstacles that they must face. Can you talk a little bit about those obstacles?
I can, sure. There's really a large number of potential obstacles. And I like to think about, for every obstacle, what the solution is, because it's sort of easier to go through the litany of obstacles and really not give adequate attention to what the solutions are. So if I can, let me just address a couple of them, and we'll talk about from both an obstacle and a solution point of view.
Certainly.
One of the things that happens a lot is there are lots of myths and misconceptions, particularly for young people who are coming back to the community, not just from a alternative residential placement, but from a correctional facility, perhaps a very high security correctional facility for juveniles. There's oftentimes a view that every young person coming out of those facilities is equally at high risk for reoffending, and therefore we really need to be focusing on them as if they're a very high-level threat to public safety. The truth is that's not at all the case. That there are a whole variety of reasons why young people end up being placed into correctional facilities. Risk to public safety is one factor. It is certainly not the only factor. And what that means is that we are putting into correctional facilities young people who may be at high need but are at relatively low risk to public safety. The obstacle that I would point out that's inherent in this is the view that, and a mindset that, these young people coming out of correctional facilities are a danger to public safety and therefore require a very high level of supervision and surveillance and monitoring. That's really not the case. If a really good assessment is done, we are in a better position to determine who in fact is more at risk to public safety and who's less at risk. And what we want to do is to take the higher risk to public safety young people who are going to be coming back in the community and thinking about both the level of supervision and also the types of supports that they're going to need so that we can keep the level of risk to an absolute minimum that would be possible. Now, for the young people who come out who are relatively low risk to public safety, we need to be very, very careful. Because if we approach them in the wrong way, we're going to face, in a sense, the self-fulfilling prophecy. We're going to make them high risk. But in fact, they're not high risk to public safety. But we can treat them in ways that we may, in fact, turn them into that. So, for example, we take a low risk to reoffending young person. We have very, very high levels of monitoring and surveillance. We're watching them very closely. What we're going to detect inevitably would be noncompliance and infractions because we're also imposing on them conditions that really are not in sync with the level of risk that they pose. But they're going to probably, because they're typical adolescents, they're going to be rather noncompliant. But the noncompliance is not an indication that they pose a threat to public safety. And if we act like it is, we're going to end up reacting in a way that's really way out of sync with the threat to public safety. And we're going to probably be making them worse. Another reason why that happens is because some of these young people essentially are rebelling and reacting negatively to a level of structure that they don't need. And so we're, in a sense, inviting them to act out and encouraging them to act out when, in fact, if we had a lower level of supervision and more reasonable sets of conditions, I think there's every reason to believe, based on the research and the evidence, that they would not have as many problems. So this one area about identifying and then intervening in a way that is in sync with the level of risk of reoffending is very, very important. Now, the young people who are coming out of secure correctional facilities who are relatively low risk to public safety but have high-level needs, we need to, I think, be mindful of what those needs are, and we need to intervene and address those needs accordingly. But that doesn't mean that we need to have high levels of monitoring and supervision, that we've got to have high levels of control for reasons I already explained. It actually could be very counterproductive. In terms of another obstacle that I would think it important to mention, it would be meaningful engagement, both of families as well as employment opportunities in the community. And education. Those three big areas, it seems to me, we often really pay either inadequate attention to, or for reasons that get very complicated, we're not able to intervene in a way that's going to ultimately produce the best circumstances for these young people. It seems to me that, therefore, we need to start working with families, we need to be focusing on educational issues, and we need to be thinking about what possibilities there's going to be for employment, particularly for mid and older age adolescents, at the very, very beginning. I don't think any of these things can wait until shortly before release. But in many instances, it's really not taken very seriously, if we're lucky, until shortly before release. And in a number of instances, it's really not taken very seriously until these young people go back out into the community, and that's really too late. Particularly for a high risk for reoffending young person, it seems to me, having them being placed on the waiting list for either a job or for going back into school, or holding out on dealing with the family until very late in the process, is a prescription for not accomplishing very much. Now, the issue oftentimes is the team, as I was indicating earlier. We may have specialists, and we may have people who focus on these particular areas, but they may not get involved early enough to really be able to intervene in the most productive and beneficial ways. So I would be arguing that we really need to get family engagement. We need to be thinking about what the educational options are going to be in the community, and we need to be thinking about where there's going to be employment, what that might be in terms of opportunities very, very early on. Now, in some places, what we hear is that, well, it could change. We're really not sure when it's going to happen. We're not really sure where they're going to go back to. And that becomes an excuse for doing nothing. And it seems to me that that just makes no sense whatsoever. And even if it's only going to be sort of a preliminary idea about what's going to be happening at release, which might be 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months from now, we need to be thinking about that as we go along. That has to be the driving force on the way we intervene, because ultimately, these kids making it is going to be how they ultimately fare when they're back in the community, not in the correctional facility, not in the out-of-home placement. The final point I would make, which I think is related here with regard to obstacles, is the whole matter of inadequate preparation for return to the community. What we see in a lot of out-of-home placements are some very good work that gets done, but the truth is, it's really not preparing them for what they're going to face when they go back into those communities. So while it may make sense for having them be manageable and be compliant when they're in the out-of-home placement, it really is not taking into account what they're likely to face when they go back out in the community. Because let's face it, a lot of these young people are going to go back to communities that are not going to be a whole lot different than when they left. And in fact, in some places, what you hear is, well, what do you expect when there's failure? They're going back to the same problems that were there from before, and that nothing has changed. It seems to me we need to be very, very careful about that mindset, because what we're really communicating to them, I think, perhaps inadvertently, but nonetheless powerfully, is that the chances that they're going to be able to make it because they're going back to a place where there's going to be challenges is very, very low, and I don't think we need to be communicating that to these young people. What we want to be focusing on is their resiliency, their strengths, their being in a position to transcend what are going to be tough situations out in the community. And it's not as if we're going to all of a sudden be able to change those circumstances. What we can do, however, is work with them so that they're in a better position to be able to deal with the negative influences that were there before. They're going to be there when they go back, and in some instances, they may be worse than when they left. And in other instances, they may be less able to deal with them because they've been away from it for a long time. That's not doing them any good. That's not doing public safety any good. So we really need to be thinking about what are we going to do for them that's going to prepare them to deal with the temptation and the challenges back out in the community. We need to deal with them on what it takes to create a new potential peer group if, in fact, they were involved with a very negative peer group before. If they had real serious family problems before, those family problems may still be in place when they get there. So we need to think about how we could have them in a better position to be able to deal with those family problems. In other instances, the families are actually very powerful supports for these young people, but there's a view in some cases that the problem is with the families and there's not much you can do with it, and therefore nobody bothers to intervene. So that would be another set of obstacles that it seems to me, if we're realistic about what these obstacles are and we focus on what the solutions are to dealing with these obstacles, we're going to be in a much better position to ultimately have impact, both on the kids who are coming back to the community who are high risk for reoffending, and also those who are low risk for reoffending, that we want to make sure we do not inadvertently turn into a high risk for reoffending young person.
The Beat was brought to you by the United States Department of Justice Cops Office. The Cops Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems.